Welcome back to the Jordan Family Podcast. This will be the part B of our second episode. So if you haven't heard the A episode yet, go back and listen to it first. So here we go. Sit back, turn your volume up for part B, episode 2 of the Jordan Family Podcast. Well, Keith, we have another story to tell. Question, just how hard-headed are the Jordans?
Oh, my. We're pretty hard-headed. But, you know, I was talking to this guy the other day that's also pretty hard-headed. It was really weird. He's getting ready to go hunting, and he was putting Elmer's glue, like lotion, on his hands. Like, I don't understand. What are you doing? And I tried to talk him out of it, but he said no. He's sticking to his guns on this one.
Oh, took me just a second, but I got it. And the jokes are free, people, for the podcast. That's a good one, Keith. You've been playing on that one, I think. So, well, let's get back to our story now. You had me going there for a little bit. I thought this was a true story you was telling, but that's a good one. Well, I was going to tell a story about Grandpa, that he may be the hardest headed of all the Jordans, and I think he might have proved it. He was still in his late teens, and Grandpa survived a .32 caliber point-blank range accidental pistol shot to the head. Can you imagine that? You remember, I mean, I'm sure anybody that knew Grandpa, I got a cat walking across my table here. Can you imagine that? We all knew Grandpa, and we all seen the bullet hole pretty much right between his eyes.
Right.
I said, and he survived it, and how?
Yeah, but, you know, I've never been shot and don't particularly want to be, but that would be, I just can't imagine what that'd be like, especially to get shot in that area.
Yeah, that area with a point blank range.
Right. I mean, you know, like watching TV, movies or whatever, old flesh wound. Well, that's not a flesh wound.
No, that was pretty much head on shot there. That .32 caliber, that was probably a pretty popular weapon back in that time period anyway.
It was. It was a very, very popular weapon. It kind of surprised me at how popular it was when I got to looking at it. So McKinley, he was shot and killed by a .32 caliber. Teddy Roosevelt, you know the story about him?
I did.
Having his, well, the one where he got shot, he had put his glasses in his jacket pocket, and then he had a rather lengthy speech, and the speeches back then, you know, they're written out and not typed or on a teleprompter, so he had wrapped up this really huge speech and put it in his pocket, and the person shot him, hit it straight for his heart, but where he had wrapped that and put it in the pocket, it stopped the bullet, and that happened to be a .32 caliber as well. And so there was that. Unfortunately, during World War II, what was used in concentration camps by the Nazis was a .32 caliber. The Archduke Ferdinand his assassination kicked off World War I. He was killed by a .32. Back then, Italy was monarchy, and the king of Italy was shot by a .32.
So we can see a pattern here.
Whole lot going on with the .32 caliber.
So it was definitely powerful enough to kill you. That's kind of what I wanted you to find out for sure. If that was a gun capable of killing you like that, then our grandpa survived a shot to the head with the same gun that has killed presidents and kings. You know what I mean? It's pretty amazing. Uncle Don, he remembered Grandpa talking about that story and a little bit about it. And I'm going to have Uncle Don. I interviewed him again and got him talking about the pistol shot. So we'll let Uncle Don kind of tell the whole story about how it happened.
Well, Uncle Don's always good for an interesting story.
Yes, he is. And I think he proves it as our podcast goes along. We'll get some funny stories out of Uncle Don. So here's Uncle Don telling about Grandpa getting shot.
They was walking to church, and a canard, he had a pistol, and he'd bought it new, and they was going to church, and he thought he'd go and shoot it, see how it shot, and he threw it back like that, and he pulled the trigger, and Dad was in behind him, and it got him in the head.
Did he go to the doctor? Or?
Yeah, they took him to Hoosier's.
Okay, so he did go to the doctor then. Okay.
He went to the doctor, and they said that they took a wire and went in that hole and pulled some of that lead out, but they didn't get it all. It would fester. You remember seeing it?
I remember that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, as you can tell, that was a pretty good story Uncle Don told about the gunshot. And I remember Grandpa saying, everything started ringing in his ears when he first got shot. And he really didn't know what happened to him. And it about knocked him out. And he remembered feeling really dizzy and warm. And he felt his face was wet. So when he wiped his face, of course, getting shot in the head, it's going to be blood. But he said that didn't really panic him as much as when he kind of got his eyes focused and all of his friends that were standing around him looking at him with the panic and the shock look on their faces is what scared Grandpa the most. Wait a minute. I hear a gunshot. Did you do that? Did you do that?
Somebody's out to stop the
Did
podcast.
You do it? Did you do that?
No.
You know what happened? My cat walked across and stepped on the gun button. No lie. That was my cat.
Yep, somebody's trying to stop the podcast.
Yeah. So I might leave this in the podcast because that was total accident.
I think you should.
That my cat tried to keep her out of the room, but she ended up busting through the door and walked across my little table. And the thing that I do with the podcast has these little buttons I can do some sound effects on, and that cat walked exactly across the gunshot. So I'm gonna leave it. So if anybody's wondering what happened, I just wanted to explain what happened. So only on the Keith and Danny Jordan Family Podcast. Well, the cat knows how to run it better than we do. So.
I'm currently picking myself up off the floor.
I'm sure that was loud in Key's ears too. So, but hopefully that gunshot came across the thing. But anyway, I was getting back to Grandpa talking about how panicked his friends was. And I'd say that if you just shot your other friend between the eyes with a gun, I think your look on your face would be better than Grandpa's. So.
Right.
But that's the only thing he really remembered about the whole thing was that. And as far as I know, he carried that piece of lead with him pretty much for close to 80 years of his life. So
yeah,
he died with a bullet in his head. So,
right.
So that's a little funny story and that I didn't realize the cat was going to get involved, but it is what it is with like I said, the Keith and Danny podcast here. You never know what's going to happen.
No, and I can attest that I did not see Danny toying with the cat, trying to lead it over that way or,
no, she walked right in front of the camera and everything because me and Keith, right. I don't know if I'll use this or not, but me and Keith's on the phone, FaceTiming each other, trying to make this thing record. Well, Keith, this time period also is this time that the United States joined World War I, which I think was April 6th, 1917. And Grandpa had a brother, William Earl. He enlisted May of 1918, and he was discharged in 1919. Here's a little story about when Uncle Earl, is what everybody called him, came home from the Army and kind of surprised everybody because I think back then news traveled so slow. It actually traveled slower than what you could travel. So here's a little story about when he came home for the first time after the war.
I remember one story he told me that when him and Uncle William, as his brother, mm-hmm. They had corn. You know where the crossroads is?
Mm-hmm.
You know where the Summers Field out along that through there? they had a patch, they had corn all out through there, and Dad said him and Will was out there hoeing that corn, and my uncle, his brother Earl, which would be my uncle Earl, was in World War One, and Dad said he looked up down 9 Mile, he said you could see almost the whole way down 9 Mile then, and he told Reb, he said, well, it looks like Earl come walking up the road, up through there. And they decided it was him. So they went out and sat on the road bank. Dad did. Said they sat there waiting on him coming up there. And said that's who it was, Earl coming home from the war.
Numb myself how that land looked now. And for them to be able to see that far back then really amazes me. They must have worked really hard to clear out much area for farming and getting open land back on those ridges. Because our lifetime, we've never seen open enough that you could see that far of somebody actually walking and recognize them up 9 Mile like that. So that kind of, that story kind of amazed me, that part of it, more than him actually coming home, but that they could see him that far away. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Again, you know, just the economics of it all is extremely important to have as much farmland as you could, just so you can make ends meet.
Yeah, so that's what that whole area was. It was definitely rural and everybody living off the land pretty much. Back to Uncle Earl. Unfortunately, he didn't live long after the war. While there, he was gassed. I couldn't really figure out by researching what it was, but more than likely it was probably chlorine or mustard gas. So he got exposed there and it damaged his lungs. And upon his return, it finally caught up with him, and he passed away April the 11th, 1921. And he was buried at Pine Grove Cemetery. We wanted to play that in a moment of silence in memory of our Uncle Earl. He may not have died in the war, but he died because of it. Much honor and respect we have for him. I found a card with Grandpa's signature for a military marker for his brother, and it was dated in 1953.
That's pretty interesting. So I'm guessing that may have been like a replacement, because I found a card. I can't remember the guy's name. It seemed like his last name was maybe D-E-L-L, but it was shortly. I mean, I'm thinking it was the 1922-23 time period that somebody had ordered a marker for him. So I'm thinking maybe the one that Grandpa ordered was maybe a replacement for him.
Very well could have been. So I think I've seen his grave out at Pine Grove before. So we'll have to make another one of them trips we'll have to make out. And
I know that I have, but it was like when I was, well, for me and you were just little
like a couple
kids.
Years, 2 or 3 years ago.
Well, probably at least 12.
Okay, but maybe we'll take a trip sometime and get some pictures of these and get us a website where we can put some of the Jordan stuff that we talk about on our website or something. So
that's a good point, because we have some interesting things that we have found, and there would be a nice way to be able to share it with anybody that would want to look at it. So.
Yeah, so we'll work on that. Well, Keith, the year is 1922, and you know what I know?
What's that?
Love is in the air.
You know what I know?
What's that?
Love, life's sweetest reward. Let it flow, and it flows back to you.
Well, apparently Grandma and Grandpa thought that too. Everett and Carrie, they was married on March 16th, 1922 by Reverend J.H. Wallace. He was a preacher at the Church of the United Brethren in Christ, which I'm not sure where that church was located or who this guy is. I'd like to do some research. If anybody out there knows who J.H. Wallace was or what that church was maybe in the area, I'd like to know that. So, but they was married at the home of Grandma's mom, Nancy Dye, which I think they lived on 9 Mile Road. And Grandpa, of course, was living kind of up Baldwin's Holler on the ridge. So that's just a straight shot down the holler pretty much to Grandma's. So that's where they got married at.
Mm-hmm.
So Keith, just in a few short years, Grandpa went through the loss of his mom, the flu epidemic, a gunshot wound, loss of his brother, and now he is married. No doubt that marriage was probably one of the few happy times that he got to experience in those years.
Yeah, because definitely a lot of tragedy right there.
In another short period of time, they were parents and had her Aunt Beulah, Aunt Reba, twins Harry and Helen, and Aunt Ruby. By the year of 1928, this is the time he started a new job and moved into a house provided by the owner of the farm he worked at. This farm was named Mount Vernon Farm and owned by Harry Shadle. Keith, I know in the past you did research about the Shadle Farm. Can you tell everybody a little bit about it?
So the Shadle Farm is definitely a very interesting look, very interesting research. Growing up, I can remember hearing about the Shadle Farm, and I always thought it was more of a local thing as far as the importance being just local. But when you go and do research, you find out that that's different, that that's not the case. And like me and you talked about the one time, so when I went and interviewed for my very first job at the accounting firm, right after I graduated from Marshall, we had the interview, and I had noticed something, you know, when I first came in there, but I thought, well, it's not going to be proper to say anything. Let's get the interview done, and then we'll address it possibly. So we did the interview, and when it finished, I got up and thanked him for his time and everything, and I said, by the way, he starts laughing because I had kind of pointed at the picture on the wall. And he starts laughing. He goes, yep, that's not too far from your neck of the woods, is it? And I said, no. And it was this huge picture of the Shadle Farm. And it was when they were having one of their field days. And there were all these planes. I mean, not just one or so, the first one. There's only three planes that came in for the first one. So I know it was definitely not the first one, because this one had, I'm going to say probably 20, maybe 25 planes lined up. It was, you know, there's a lot of planes there that's ready for taking people up on for a ride just to get to say that they've been in an airplane before, you know. But Henry Shadle, Harry Shadle, he finished the home in 1926, and I think most of the farm buildings by 1927. And he wanted to have a farm that was known for having prized livestock, and he initially raised some prized Leghorns, some Belgium horses, and some very valued hogs. He was very interested in having the purebred lines, and he ended up going and purchasing some brown Swiss, some Guernsey, Jersey, and Holstein cattle. And it was one of those things that the quality of those cattle became so good that it kind of forced him into doing a dairy. And he ended up building a distributing plant in Charleston. And before long, the farm that Grandpa had worked on was the leader in the West Virginia dairy industry. At one point, they kept track of all the milk production by these different cattle. At one point, they were like keeping track of the production of the milk by the cattle in the state of West Virginia. And of those milk producers, the top 15, 13 of those came from the Shadel farm. 13 out of the top 15. So thousands of visitors would visit the farm to just see the horses and the cattle. Then, in 1929, he thought it would be a good idea to have a field day. And a field day would be where people would be invited to the farm. That would basically end up with like around 5,000 people visiting the farm. And they would, like I said, they brought the planes in. And people would take the short plane rides, and they were free. And there was, like, all kinds of dignitaries that would come on field day. It was not uncommon for the governor, previous governors, senators. So we had the senators that would show up. And I had said earlier about him having a very good line of the brown Swiss. I think it may have been some of the very first brown Swiss in the area. And it was such a good line that the Brown Swiss Cattle Association, which was headquartered in Wisconsin, there was like several in attendance from them that came to check these brown Swiss out. It was not uncommon for the West Virginia Commissioner of Agriculture to show up. There were some professors from Ohio State. Here's an interesting thing. 4-H clubs and the Concord Baptist Church served the food. Leon Band and an orchestra from Charleston provided the music. And they ended up finishing the day off with a big barn dance.
I think it is so interesting that our family had a part in the success of Shadel Farm and making history there in those years. This is a good place to wrap up episode 2. In the next episode, we will continue with more stories from the farm. So stay tuned for more to come on the Jordan Family Podcast.